Welcome to the Head Shepherd Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Ferguson, CEO here at NextGen Agri International, where we help livestock managers get the best out of their stock. Before we get started, thank you to our two fantastic sponsors for continuing to sponsor this podcast. MSD Animal Health is perhaps better known as Cooper's Animal Health in Australia and for their Allflex range across the world, with a comprehensive suite of animal health and management products. Heinegger is a one-stop shop for wool harvesting and animal fibre removal. The Heinegger team have a deep understanding of livestock agriculture, backed by Swiss engineering and a family business dedicated to manufacturing the best. We are grateful to our sponsors for their support, helping us bring Head Shepherd to you each week. And now it's time to get on with this week's episode. Welcome back to Head Shepherd. This week we've got Alf Collins from ALC Brahmins. But before we get into that, just quickly mention we've got our live tonight. So Nigel Kerrin's coming on to the Hub Live. One not to be missed. If you want to get some questions into Nigel, jump on there and listen to what we've got to say. We'll try and I'll try and have some good questions, but it would be great for you to have some as well and answer your direct questions. It's on at 8 p.m. New Zealand time or 6 p.m. Eastern States, or anyway, everyone else can do the maths on that. But yeah, jump on there and ask your questions. Sophie, what have you found out about this week?
So I was perusing the sheep scientific research papers and I came across some research done last year which looked at the udder morphology or structure in comparison to the live weight gain of their lambs. I used to work on a sheep dairy in the UK and in New Zealand, and yeah, sheep udders are my jam and I'm quite interested in it. I thought listeners would be too. So the trial that used udders were assessed 3 days post-weaning, and there was multiple measurements taken from udder width to depth, to teat placement and the udder cleft. And several of the individual udder and teat traits were identified as predictors of weaning weight. In that study, the udder morphology traits collectively contributed to 8% of the overall variation in weaning weight. The mean weaning weight was increased by 2 and 4 kgs, with changes from 100 millimetres to 400 millimetres for udder length and udder width respectively. So the bigger the udder, the heavier the lamb essentially. And weaning weight increased by a mean of 3 kgs if the udder depth score went from 1, which is small, to a score 3. And yeah, it's udder width and depth are moderate to high heritability. So it's not something we necessarily selectively breed on, but it is heritable and something to measure.
Excellent. So we'll have that paper somewhere on the Hub or somewhere people can find.
Yep, that'll be on the Hub this morning.
Awesome. Thanks, Sophie. So we'll get underway with this week's show. We've got Alf Collins Jr. joining us. Alf's from ALC Brahmins. He's sort of, I guess, from a family that bred for reproduction in Brahmins for years, with Alf Collins Sr. and his Alf Jr.'s mum as well. The whole family involved. But I think a really interesting chat around the focus on improving reproduction in Brahmins, and I love the concept of if they're not making you money, you turn them into money in terms of cattle, which makes a lot of sense. So we'll welcome Alf Collins to Head Shepherd. Welcome, Alf Collins, to Head Shepherd.
Yeah, thanks, Ferg. Thanks for having me on your show.
Excellent. Alf, you've grown up breeding cattle with a big focus on performance. Maybe if you could just start by talking us through how the ALC herd has evolved and the business that is today.
Yeah, I guess that it's the Brahma genetics that we're using today started many years ago, probably in the mid-50s. My grandfather introduced Brahman cattle into his British herds at the time of Hereford and Shorthorn in the Marlborough district, and that was unheard of in those days. Most people thought that they should end up in the zoo, these Brahman cattle, and so he was sort of forward-thinking, but he saw the benefits that you know, when he got the F1 progeny and the lack of labour inputs he needed to put into them and the production he was receiving. So he continued along that line. And my father then continued, and my mother in their own business. And, they started off out of a family partnership with not much money and not many cattle. And there was a need for efficient cattle business, basically, and the Brahman cattle were the most efficient breed that they could find and use it and to run a profitable business. They really got into the analysis side of the herd during that time. And then winding forward, Louise and I come out of that family partnership, and which where we are today. So, and we've continued the same thing. We came out of the, our family partnership with a lot of debt to get out, as everyone does, and start up. And we needed to run efficient cattle business. And so the performance recording and the adapted genetics has certainly been the path that's taken us to where we are.
Excellent. So, yeah, so you and Louise and at least two or three kids there running around now today?
Yeah, that's right. Our kids are getting up now. That the our oldest son's actually started back with us full time now. So, but yeah, we've got three kids in the business, and you know, today we're spread out over three properties. That where the property we live on's Gundaroo. It was my mother's father's property originally, and we were fortunate enough to be able to buy that after his passing. It's 15,000 acres, and it's where we run the. It's the headquarters and where we run the main ALC breeding herd. And we've got Tondara Station, which is about 400 kilometres north of here, but sits about 200 kilometres southwest of Townsville in North Queensland. It's 25,000 acres, and we run seed stock cows up there too, along with some commercial cattle breeding enterprise. And it's also where we run our sale bulls. So unlike a lot of other seed stock operations, we sort of run our bulls in our hardest country because we find that the easiest place to select the best cattle and for what we're selecting for. And then we run another property called Brides Creek, 600 kilometres west of here, which is about 900 kilometres south of Tondara at a place called Blackall. And it's got a few breeders there as well. It's 32,500 acres and predominantly used to grow out young commercial cattle and fatten, grass-fatten steers. The rainfall on Gundaroo and Tondara, where our breeders mostly are, is around that 600-650 mil average. And Brides Creek is about 400 to 450 millimetres of average rainfall. So it's a lower, what we call the dry tropics country.
But healthier country out there? That's why you're fattening cattle out there? Or?
Yeah, it's probably it's drier, stronger country, but more marginal rainfall and less reliable rainfall. So by having dry cattle out there, we can, if we need to reduce stocking numbers, you know, it's easier to reduce numbers of steers than it is to step out of the breeding herds. And so it just gives us that buffer to decrease if we need to, you know.
Yeah, excellent. So, yeah, I think, what's that total up to, 50,000 acres or something? Or so fairly?
70,000 over the three.
My math's not too good.
I might have said it right, but, yeah, it's at 70,000 acres and around 6,000 head all up over the three places.
Yeah, right on. Excellent. So what proportion of them is this sort of 1,500, 1,700 seed stock cows in that operation? Or?
Yeah, so it's about the breeder break up 1,700 odd seed stock females and about 1,200 commercial females.
Yeah, righto. Excellent. Righto, probably one of the toughest questions you'll get today from me is what is the last thing you changed your mind about?
that was a good one. I didn't know where to go with that, but, you know, it depends how deep and how far back we need to go. But, you know, probably the most important or influential recent thing I changed my mind about was it was probably a mindset change. You know, as we grew our business when I was a bit younger, we were focused on production and efficiency and growing the business, and that was our total focus. And as we had a family and the children are older now, starting to come back, and I guess the importance of enjoying what we do has become very important. And particularly if we're going to do it for a long time over multi-generations. And funnily enough, that mindset change to go away from the, you know, those other things are what grew us our business, and so they weren't bad things to be focused on, but just changing the mindset to a more enjoyable environment, make sure everyone's enjoying it. Funnily enough, we're probably more profitable and more efficient and growing faster. So I guess that's probably the biggest change that's affected us over the years. Yeah,
fantastic, and that's exactly why I asked the question, because it brings out those things that we may not talk about otherwise. But yeah, it's interesting how getting the head right can ends up being a productive outcome anyway, and we all have to head down, bum up for a while in business, but yeah, we're going to put our head up and smell the roses, and it can have lots of benefits.
Yeah, I guess it doesn't never changes, does it? That's the given.
Yeah.
And so we still focus on it, but we sometimes forget to focus on the real stuff, and that's enjoy it while we're going.
Yeah, definitely. And there is something, I don't know if everyone feels it, I certainly do, there's something romantic, might not be the right word, but Northern Queensland, like there's, sort of cattle cruising around out there in that native sort of country, is there's something pretty special about it. So there'd be good days to enjoy. I mean, not the long droughts, but there's certainly amazing days to see fat cattle cruising around in long grass. There's some amazing days.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's not hard to enjoy it. It's essentially it's why we do it when we really dig down into it. And the main thing is to don't lose focus on that, I guess.
Yeah, 100%. So if we get into the breeding aspect, which is kind of what we talk a lot about here at Shepherd, but not always. But one of your policies I was reading on your website, which I really liked, was not owning cattle get converted into dollars, which I think is a great way of putting it. So that's basically if they don't rear a calf, they're gone. How's that stringent selection criteria changed the cattle over the years? Like, what have you seen change, I suppose, over how much has that been successful?
Yeah, well, that came out of the generations before me as well. Like I said before, about building and growing our businesses and families. But I guess what's changed in the herd is that the predictability and reliability of the herd. You know, there's been so many cattle thrown out for not working. What's left and what's been shaken out of the system, we can back in. So, as far as cost of production and performance that we're expecting and forecasting for our economic stuff, you know, the herd stand up. And the biggest thing in our environment that is probably not so much droughts or how much rain we get, but it's the variation in seasons we get. So we can go, you know, that Tondara block can go from 300 mils of rain to 1,200 mils of rain, and yet the average is 650. So I guess the biggest thing we deal with is how can we have a cattle herd that it can work under green conditions and then turn around next year and work under very dry conditions and sometimes for a few years in a row. And so by that selection of just keeping what works, it's a simple selection, but it's just the breeding herd actually, it surprises me. Like last year was a dry year here, and I predicted a lot lower conception rates than we got, and our body condition in cows was down, and the cow stood up, and often that happens. You know, they stand up and they produce.
Yeah, excellent. And one of the things I was reading is you're very stringent on the 1st of October the bulls go in, so the management or the rules stay the same, and so the cows have to fit the rules regardless of what season. So, and that's breeding in that reliability.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we don't change our production year because of the rain. You know, because like I said, the reliability is not there. So the wet season can start in October. It may start in March, and we don't know. So we've taken an approach that we'll select cattle that work regardless, and only keep those at work. And funny, over time, you know, when we started here, we were in a 5-month joining period, and that was regarded as selection pressure. Then we've wound that back now to a 2.5-month joining period, still starting in the 1st of October, and our green date or the date that we're most likely to receive 2 inches of rain is the 15th of December. So basically, our bulls are coming out when their rain starts, and that goes against what a lot of people talk about in management, but in our genetics, what we're selecting for is what we call a dry season mating most years. So a cow herd that says, I'll put my hand up and work whether you rain on me or not. If you do rain on me, I'll go even harder, but I definitely won't fold up if it doesn't rain. So we've shortened that mating period, and I guess a big change that's come out of that is we've knocked a a full wet season off our production life of our animals. So we're getting to the same sale weights one wet season earlier than we were when we started. Just by having those cattle work fast and early, and you know that in our country that equates to 12 months because we basically have 6 months of dry and 6 months of wet, roughly, if it all works out.
Yeah.
So if you miss one wet season, you got to wait through the whole next dry one and then the next wet one to produce. And so it's significant.
Yeah, so anyone can do the maths that 12 months earlier turnoff is going to be handy, and that's huge, isn't it? The cattle breeding are the result of, so I guess, 6 decades through the generation of consistent selection pressure, particularly on fertility, which is probably, if we're being fair, wasn't a strength of the Brahmin, and that's why I guess fertility. And when any cattle enterprise, if they're not bringing in a calf, they're not making your money. There's no way around that. In addition to seeing that improvement and that reliability improvement, is there anything else that you've noticed change in the cattle in your time or in your generations before you? I'm often intrigued by some of the unexpected things that might change with our selection pressure.
Yeah, Ferg, I guess the Brahmin it's had a hard knock for fertility. In saying that, the conditions and where the Brahmin operates, most other breeds die. Heat exhaustion or parasite load or lack of nutrition. And so I guess, the survival mechanism, nature's survival mechanism of the Brahmin was don't die, don't reproduce in the fact that I'm not going to die.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
I guess that's where that's where it came from. But I guess the approach that we've taken and my father and grandfather have taken is let's make a selection for the cattle who put their hand up and work regardless. And whatever the trigger is, it turns it on and off. We're saying just turn it on, leave it on, and we'll take care of the rest. And so that's how it's evolved. And I guess as far as the fertility in the Brahmin breed goes, it was probably more to do with excuses made why they shouldn't have to have a calf rather than why they should have a calf that there is some fertility issues in the breed. But certainly we've shown in our herd that if you select for it, there is in the conditions that they're given, they're as fertile as anything we could run there, but we don't have to spend as much money on having them there. In production costs, but I guess to get back to your question, I went a bit off track there, but an interesting, and I hadn't thought of that until I saw that question, but I looked into it a bit, but an interesting thing that I did notice is we've never made a selection for intramuscular fat or measured fat and selected for it. We have selected for reproduction speed and doability under poor conditions for many years, but as we did measure cattle through research, contributing to research herds and that sort of thing, the herd has come up high in the breed for IMF and fats. And nice. I suppose so that shouldn't be surprising, I guess, in the fact that the research has shown there's a correlation between IMF and fertility and, fat is energy. And essentially we're selecting for cattle that will store energy and draw on those reserves in a dry time. But yeah, so that was probably the one that stood out.
Yeah, that's really cool. And you don't know me well, but you don't know how much that really lights me up as have sort of things we've seen elsewhere. But I think it's always really interesting where you've had long-term selection like you have and what other things change that we – yeah, and that's a great example that makes sense, but not all biology makes sense. So it's great to hear that. I mean, one thing – yeah, I think often – I don't know, maybe it's just me because I grew up in the south, not in the north, but we kind of expect – well, in my head, Brahmins have always been in the north, but I sort of forget that it's only been sort of last, 70 years or so since, and the massive change that they made by being able to be so more adapted to the diseases and actually live there and thrive there rather than in the good season and stay alive in the bad ones is what they're great for. I read again on your website that you don't do any tick or worm treatment, and ticks are probably especially or can be a problem out there. Has that been hard to achieve, that sort of low-cost strategy? I guess it goes hand in hand. They've got to turn up and deliver, and so if that's for the tick burden or not, they still need to deliver. Has that made it harder to breed cattle, or has it sort of been innate in the Brahmins and not too bad?
No, it hasn't been hard in the sense that the Brahman breed is evolved to be a tropical breed, so it's naturally is adapted to parasites. And I guess most of the adapted breeds that I've seen, you know, I've looked at them in South America and South Africa. Where it starts to go wrong is where people get involved, and people take adapted breeds and then try to make them look beautiful. So they then change the environment and take away the parasites and add food, and all of a sudden we can breed adapted parasites and non-adapted cattle within that breed. Yeah. And if that makes sense. So it's I guess it wasn't hard to do. It just meant we had to be disciplined. And again, it came back from comes back to trying to run a profitable cattle business, and the fact that we didn't want to spend money on ticker sides. We don't want to run around with poison on our back anyway. It never made sense to us to pour poison on a cow and then eat it anyway. Yeah. And so we just had to be disciplined in the fact that we weren't going to do it. And a part of as I'm sure you know, like a part of getting resistance to parasites is they have to get a load on them anyway. They have to get worms and they have to get ticks.
Yeah.
And so we have to let that happen and select the ones that can't handle it. And we see that through reproduction. We see that through loss of weight gain and just remove those cattle. And, yeah, so it was just a disciplined approach. And obviously we had some cattle that don't look very pretty. Some cattle get chewed up by flies and that. And we just need to take those cattle out and keep doing it. And we continue today to do it. And, you know, obviously there's less and less, you know, all our cattle get ticks on them because they live in the ticks, but they don't get affected by – they don't get a big enough burden of ticks to decrease their production. And far as skin conditions with buffalo fly, after the preg test every year, that's the last thing we do. We go through the cows, and anything with fly lesions on them, they get taken out of the herd.
Yeah, right.
And we'll go back and analyse that by sire. If there's a linkage here, we'll get rid of the sires too. But, yeah, so it's just a disciplined approach, and it's the old simple old thing. You get what you select for, and that's just how it happened.
Yeah, excellent. I guess with your scale these days, at least you can, the selection pressure you're able to apply is a lot higher than if you had 100 head or whatever. You put all these things in and you wouldn't end up with many cattle at the end of the day, but having lots means you can, and I guess the time of selection as well is really helps on that. Temperament of the cattle is something, me growing up in the sheep industry, is something I'm always keen on, breeding for temperament, but it's listed high on your breeding objective list as well. How's that changed over the years? What's that selection pressure look like, and how are the cattle responding?
Yeah, it's the temperament. It stemmed back from my parents, I guess. Our business has evolved out of family businesses, so it's all the cattle have always been worked by mum and dad and a bunch of kids, you know, from when they're small kids. So quiet cattle for safety and enjoyment of working them has always been important, and so bad temperament could never be tolerated. And like you said before, you can't just, when you're building numbers, you can't just go and throw everything out that's not desirable. And so in the early days, my parents would just take any cattle that weren't up to a standard temperament-wise and put them in one paddock. Then they'd mate. All the bulls that got used had to be very quiet, and temperament's a heritable trait. So over the years, some of those progeny would go back into that bad temperament herd and the rest would come into the main herd. And then in this country, we always get a dry year or two and we need an excuse to reduce numbers. So eventually there becomes a time where that paddock, whole paddock can go. And that's just how it's been over the years. And, you know, the herd now is very quiet. We run a fair few cattle with not many people, and the temperament certainly what allows us to do that. And we've run on adjustment and lease country with some very poor facilities, and having quiet cattle has allowed us to still operate in those facilities without any drama. And it goes on too, you know, the cattle settle in paddocks. They don't stress on trucks. You know, if they go to feed yards, they go in and relax and eat. And I guess probably what we call temperaments is a couple of things to look at is we're not looking for a dopey, slow-moving, you know, some people call that quiet, but we still need cattle that respond. and move office, but we need cattle who can handle stress and so will pressure. So what we're looking for in temperament when we're selecting is if we put pressure on, they can deal with it and get over it quickly, and that's the way we select for it.
Yeah, it's a good point, and one of the maybe unintended consequences of selection in other breeds or other species is where you get two nuts on it, you've got an animal that you can't actually physically move because they're just so, and so that kind of doesn't work. And it might work all right in the south, but it's not going to work too well in the north where you've got to move them long distances.
No, often you'll see cattle that are, I call them doughy, or they'll sulk, and that's certainly we don't want that. We want them to be responsive but handle it.
Yeah. Growth's obviously a focus as it is in any livestock business, but it's always a bit of a challenge because often, like you say, in your objective, you're chasing moderate frame size as well, and those two things don't always go hand in hand. What's your sort of strategy to achieve, I guess, early growth when they can, but not grow out to massive cow frame?
Yeah, it's the big challenge, isn't it? We're selecting for growth, and we've seen it in plenty of other breeds, and it's in the Brahma breed. But I guess it comes back to that efficiency. We're looking that cow efficiency is what we're trying to that's the factory that's going to consume the most. And so we've always stayed away from the extreme end of growth. Deliberately, and the extreme end of scale of frame, and so if we're selecting breeding stock bulls, we'll deliberately not use those real high end fellas, as well as we won't use the low end either. But deliberately stay away from the real extreme high end, and if we get growth through frame and not muscling ability or without early puberty, we'll stay away from that as well. And so I guess that's what's helped us, and then it's not unusual for in the south, in southern breeds, but in Brahman breeds, it's quite unusual to do a yearling mating on heifers, and we've done that for some years now, and that's a really good way to take out late maturing framey cattle.
Yeah,
essentially they just continue growing and forget to reproduce. And so that starts there, and then going on to the cow herd, every year our cows calve in reasonable condition and then lose condition. That's just the nature of the north.
Yeah.
And so long as we continue to have that pressure, and like I was saying, we've got a dry season mating while everything's lactating and losing condition, so high maintenance cows find it very tough to survive in the system. And that really drives that efficiency there as well. And, of course, we're looking at mature cow weight EBVs as well while we're doing bull selection.
Yeah, 100%. We might go to muscling or fleshing now. I see that ranks pretty highly as well. Obviously, that's the bit we eat, so it's important to have that. But are there other benefits we've found early puberty sort of links in sheep. Are they there in Brahmins or with muscling and fleshing?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah, it's right up there. Like you say, we're a beef breed to start with, so we need to have some carcass to sell. But I guess the ability of the animal to eat poor nutrition and gain flesh or condition is like you've seen in your sheep is highly correlated to what we see in reconceptions, and going back to your growth thing as well. You can get the same weight out of a smaller frame fleshy animal or I call them a cardboard cow, a really narrow tall one, and come up with the same weight. And
might steal that off you, mate. That sounds good.
Anyway, so of course when you go to those big framey fellas, you get longer bone growth and later maturity patterns and high maintenance and all the rest of it, and we don't want that. So it's just another selection criteria we can use when we're selecting for those profit drivers.
Yeah, 100%. And so, you've already mentioned mature cow weight EBVs, but EBVs or estimated breeding values are pretty powerful. Well, some of us believe so anyway. And I guess it's probably fair to say still pretty underutilized in northern cattle, fairly well utilized in the south and getting a bit of penetration in the sheep industries. But I guess, how do you use those breeding values in conjunction with what your eyes are telling you to sort of make those heifer selections or bull selections?
Yeah, so we Yeah, it's starting to. In the north, it's gaining traction as well. You know, it's nowhere near as well used in the southern breeds, but a lot of it's because there's nowhere near as many people measuring,
yeah,
and putting data into the system. But you know, the progressive end of the commercial world is certainly taking it up and starting to look for it and use it in their selection criteria. So yeah, we use it when we're making breeding selection on bulls. We once we're happy with the phenotypic stuff, the structural soundness and temperament, the standard stuff people look at, then we go to the EBVs, and I guess the EBVs give us a platform to bring everything back to the same level and remove the environment, and then we can make selection just on the genetic merits of those animals. And it allows us, you know, we use it's particularly in the fertility traits. Very hard to see that. It's very hard to see female rebreeding production looking at a bull standing in the middle of a yard. So, it gives us a genetic background on what's behind those cattle and the way they're programmed to perform and drive our herd in the direction we want to go to. So it's probably a simple way to put it. It's the final thing we go to. Once we're happy with everything else, then we can have a perfect-looking animal standing there. If it's not genetically programmed to drive our herd the way we want to go in those traits that we're looking for, they're no use to us.
Yeah, yeah. I imagine days to calving gets a fair, that'll be up high up the list of the breeding bays you're looking at.
Oh, yeah. Days to calving and scrotal size, you know, scrotal size for the puberty. And scrotal size, we measure at 400 days. So it's, you know, standard in Brahman is 600 days. We take it back to 400 to try and really drive that puberty stuff. And days to calving is, they're the two main ones we look at.
Yeah.
70% of our profitability comes from fertility. So we get that right first, and then we go back to our growth traits.
Yeah.
After that, you know, but without reproduction, we don't have a business.
Yeah, yeah, I really like that on your website. The for every $10 margin, $7 of that's coming from fertility, and I can't remember the other two. Well, growth was one of them, but and all eating quality and growth probably, or anyway, the other stuff. Once you get a live calf, the abattoir, you get some value for that. But actually, getting that calf there is a big chunk of the money.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that's where you breed a production herd. It's the main. The inventory we run in our herd are mostly breeding cows. So, for every cow run, we need to get production. It's and the only way to get production out of the cow herd is weaning calves, weaning live calves, and reconceiving. And yeah, so that's the first thing. We must have that first.
Yeah. Obviously, you're working at the starting end, getting them going quicker. Longevity, I mean, I know the Brahma bulls are pretty good at hanging around and cows, is that something you sort of look at, or that's I guess where's longevity sit in and what you're looking at?
Yeah, it's I didn't realize how good the Brahman bull was for longevity till I had some experience with some other breeds, but
we won't list those breeds,
so longevity in the cow herd is certainly important, you know, that and the way we measure longevity is the ability to wean calves every year. It's the only way we measure it. And with the pressure we're putting on the cow herd, there's not many cows get to live long in our system. But those that do are certainly the genetics that we want to reproduce and continue forward. Bulls, we're very disappointed if you can't get, you know, if you can't work a bull till he's 8 or 10 years old. That comes back to structural soundness, I guess. But I didn't realize how important or how good it is to have cattle that do that.
Yeah.
But
we did a little bit of work with some northern beef producers and kind of using the stats you would use down south on how long bulls might last for you. You had to buy a whole lot more bulls than what you do when you're buying Brahmas that hang around for 10 years anyway.
Well, that's right. We get typically in the north, sort of 7 years of age is where you'd kick them out, just because, not because they break down, it's just because they get older and grumpier and start to fight and stay on their own and that sort of thing. But Most of them don't break down due to structure. But yeah, it's certainly good for bull breeders, I guess, to turn them over every 2.5 years. But it's not so good if you're buying them.
No, exactly. Maybe just quickly on your so that strategy of finishing bulls up north, which is, as you said at the start, is probably the opposite of what most people do, but it's a great concept of, so they get pushed up and so they go there, move, they're weaned as bull calves and up north, are they? Or how does that system work for your sale bulls?
Yeah, so some of the bulls are born up there. There's seed stock cows up there.
Yeah.
And the ones that are born down here at Gundaroo, they get sent up there straight after they're weaned. And it's what we call coastal forest country, Indian cooch country, which runs out of protein and energy early in the season compared to the better country. So just, you know, our clientele and our commercial herds run on harder country, so we want to make our performance selection under conditions as hard as we got.
Yeah.
And those high-maintenance cattle who can't handle it, they simply just fall out of the system and can't handle it. So it's, it's just our sale bulls, when we present them, are presented off grass anyway. So we don't have to have a big fat animal. Our clientele aren't looking for that.
Yeah.
It means we don't have 900, 800 kilo bulls to sell, but the comment we get from all our clients in Northern Australia is they turn up and continue to do well and produce a lot of calves, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And then probably final question on the breeding is, so all, obviously DNA parenting is the only way you can roll. Are they all parent verified? Is that how you work it?
Yeah. Everything's DNA parent verified. That came about years ago and the bull dominance is a big thing. In calf getting ability and all our clients have large, most of them have larger herds and multiple sire matings and in some areas there's even a few feral cattle still running around. So the ability for bulls to go out there and fight and earn their position to get calves is an important thing in Northern Australia. I think even going further, we're talking about longevity of bulls, is I think it might even go further in the fact that some bulls prepared to fight and some bulls can handle a fight. You know, some bulls just seem to break easier than others.
Yeah.
And so in our seed stock herd years ago, we decided with the feedback from our clients to go multiple mating on everything. And then because we're DNA testing, well, we can get the dam verification at the same time.
Yeah.
It's come back to what we said at the start about enjoying it more too. We're running bigger herds of cows now with more bulls, so we're working mobs less. It all feeds into that as well.
Yeah, it'd be a relatively stressful time having lots of single sire mobs and bulls fighting over fences and carrying on, I imagine. Whereas it'd be easier in big mobs, big herds.
Yeah, definitely. It's if you're trying to run a single sire herds accurately. You spend a lot of time fixing fences and chickens. it's certainly helped into that.
Yeah, excellent, Alf. That's been a really great insight into the business. What's the future there at ALC? Do you think there's a next innovation or technology that you'd like to see change, or you think things are ticking along pretty well?
Oh, things are ticking along well. Like we're increasing, with the help of the polygene DNA test. We're certainly producing a lot more polled cattle now. We've changed from, we were about 15% polled up to 55-56% now, and that'll continue. We'll keep squeezing reproduction. If we can knock another couple of weeks off that, we will. Keep driving that yearling mating as hard as we can and finding those most productive females. I've thought about delving more into carcass in our breed. We're very conscious about selecting, getting too many traits and doing none of them very well, or honing in on what's really important and making them work very well. As far as technology in the in the so I'm not saying we won't delve more into that, but we may. And like I said, the herd is pretty strong for intramuscular fat now, so it's something that may interest us. But it's strong in the Brahman breed. It certainly wouldn't be strong compared to some of the others. But I guess as far as a technology for the industry looking forward, I'd love to see more work done on carcass or tenderness identification post slaughter and grading of carcasses along that line, and then using post slaughter techniques to change eating quality of carcasses, rather than spend so much time talking about different breeds and stuff that we can't actually practically use in a lot of the area we run in. So I'd really like to see that go advance. The technology's been around for 20-odd years, but it's obviously the cost of doing it is the cost of using it is prohibitive, you know, as far as tender stretching and stimulation. And aging and those sort of things. But I really think that, you know, practically if we can get back to running animals that are adapted to the environment in which they're running in, is a far healthier and sustainable way looking forward than it is trying to bring unadapted species into areas where they're trying to die, you know. So it's I'd really like to see that grow legs, and it'll stem on from there. You know, we're going into a healthier world and a more we're looking at carbon sequestration and things like that. Other industries are looking at us, so that's going to come back to less diesel burnt and more grass and pastures grown and eaten, you know. So it's the cow will become king, and we need adaptation will play a huge part in that process.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I'm sure if you look around in the country that you're running, you're not the best way to get protein out of there is to put it through a cow and get it. And it is interesting how it's always that challenge between getting an animal that's perfectly adapted to the system and then sort of with the consumer pressure at the other end. But, yeah, I think you're right. There is some great stuff that can happen post-slaughter that certainly I've seen great evidence of, and, yeah, I'm probably not close enough to know where that sits in terms of priorities. But, it's a really good point. Alf, that's been a fantastic chat this morning. I really appreciate your time, and, great to hear all the good things going out there in our ALC. It's a far cry from Christchurch, but it's great to hear that the Brahman breed in such good health. One final question to show my naivety, but red versus grey, is there any difference or is it just preference?
No, it's hair colour. It's hair colour and it's a preference. We in our business, I don't care what colour they are. Once you pull the hide off, they're all the same. Yeah, it's you know, they come from two different backgrounds, basically. You know, the red Brahman come back, it was developed, you know, with the Gur and Sindhi breeds years ago, and the grey breed was the Nellore and Gujarat breeds, so that's where it all started. So people now have preference on it, and there's good cattle in both colours, but it's something we don't look at. It's like trying to pick the state origin team on what colour their hair is.
That's a very good way of putting it. Excellent. Yeah, no, it's always intrigued me that some people seem to have a preference when I can't. Yeah, I was wondering if there is any difference, but that's awesome. Thanks, Alf. Awesome. Thanks very much for your time, mate.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Luke.
Thanks again to Heiniger, who are proud world leaders in the manufacturing and supply of professional sheep shearing and clipping equipment. Thank you to M&SD Animal Health and Norflex Livestock Intelligence. They offer an extensive livestock product portfolio focused on animal health management, all backed up by exceptional service. We thank both of these companies for their ongoing support of the Head Shepherd podcast.